Ladies and gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to welcome the Saker back to the Saleri Report. This is a man who needs no introduction. Needless to say, Saker, we have a lot to talk about today. let's just dive into what's going on in the Middle East, because that's where we sort of ended last time. And let's just dive in and bring us down on what's been happening in Syria. And then let's move out from Syria into the, of course, President Trump was visiting the Middle East. I want to hear about that trip as well. But bring us up to date on Syria.
Well, I would characterize the situation as absolute chaos. I mean, as we speak, yesterday night, we had the U.S. again bomb Syrian forces under the pretext that we're getting too close to U.S. forces, which are there to begin with illegally. And it's absolute chaos. Then we had the trip of Donald Trump to the Middle East, where he went to the two spots where he could go, really, where he had still support, which is Saudi Arabia and Israel. Both are very, very bad allies, I think, for the United States. And now all hell is breaking loose around Qatar, which I don't think is a coincidence. So what we're seeing is basically the United States and the Saudis are kind of in a similar situation. They're both in a position of weakness. Their policies have largely failed. Their use of force has failed. And now they're trying to show that this is not the case by throwing weight around in a, I would say, generally very ineffective way, which just further serves to make them look weak, and that makes them insecure, and that makes them throw even more weight around. So it's a downward spiral, which is potentially very dangerous for everybody involved.
A couple things happened when Trump was in Saudi Arabia. One, he made an agreement with the Saudis for a huge arms sale, which, if you read the reports, puts about 78... Well, it puts an extraordinary profit in the hands of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, two of the largest U.S. defense contractors. So very big deal there. That's number one. Number two, if you look at what the Saudis have said to Qatar since, the Saudis have basically shut down relationships with Qatar, as have others, Egypt included. And, you know, Qatar is really a financial center in the Middle East, and I think there's a 10-day period when everybody has to leave, but it means the Saudi border shuts down, which I believe most of the food comes across by land, not by sea.
If I recall correctly, 40%.
Okay, so...
I think it was 40% the figure, yes. And there's a naval blockade also and an air blockade around them.
You're talking about potentially collapsing one of the most significant financial centers in the Middle East, intentionally.
Well, I don't think it's going to get that far because I don't think they will succeed. But are we talking about a possible very severe crisis? Yes. First of all, it is an act of war. Only the UN Security Council has the right to impose any kind of sanctions. When you're talking about the shutting down of, essentially, Qatar is surrounded by all sides except for one, you know, this is essentially an act of war, and there's a threat of war in the air. But I also noticed that President Putin spoke with the Qataris. Erdogan indicated he opposes that policy, and he offered his aid. I don't know of an official Iranian statement right now, but I'm pretty sure that this is also going to be on condemning the pressure on Qatar. And what they already have said today is the latest terrorist attack inside Tehran. The Iranians have blamed the Saudis for it. So, you know, Saudis have failed at everything they've tried. Look at their absolutely failed policy in Yemen. They failed in Syria. I mean, I almost would say whatever the Saudis undertake, you can pretty much be sure they'll fail. And I think they'll fail in this case, too. It is, first of all, as you say, a huge financial center. But secondly, it's also there are American installations there. the Saudis are entering a territory which is vital in many strategic aspects. You can't just mess around with it like it's not Yemen. That's basically what I'm trying to say.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Would they have proceeded to do this without an agreement with the Americans to do it?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure that there is a unified American foreign policy at work right now. I've been doubting that for a long while. I've been doubting that at the end of the Obama presidency, and I see that repeating right now again. Because clearly I would not argue that this isn't in the interest of the United States at all. And yet Trump has made at least one tweet indicating that he kind of supports it. I think the only countries who benefit from that are, first of all, Israel, of course, which I suspect is the prime mover behind the scenes in that situation right now, and the Saudis, who are basically, I think, cornered and desperate, but they're acting in a very dangerous and reckless way. But I'm not at all convinced that there is a unitary, unified American foreign policy at work anywhere in the Middle East at all.
Right.
I would say Trump has signaled to the Saudis that you're welcome, you know, to put pressure and try to get to Qatar to walk the proper line and realign the Qataris realign themselves with Saudis. Yes, probably. But did the Saudis take it one step too far, or were they encouraged by somebody by making, you know, ultimatums, threats, and essentially taking actions which are basically tantamount to an act of war? If that's what Trump agreed upon, it just makes him irresponsible. And it doesn't seem that there's no rationale behind it, in my opinion.
Well, the U.S. Central Command is in Qatar for the Middle East, correct?
Yes, and they've already said that they're not moving out, because there have been some conversations about that, but they also declared their neutrality. Now, I don't know how you're neutral if the country you are stationed in, if it comes to a military action, if it gets invaded or attacked, I don't know how you can have a position of neutrality. I mean, that's very... Imagine the image that projects the United States. You know, if you are an ally of the U.S. and the U.S. has a major, truly strategic installation on your territory and doesn't even pay you back by defending you, what's the point of being allied to the United States?
Right.
I mean, the obvious comparison would be compare what the Russians did for the Syrians and what the United States apparently is not willing to do for the Qataris, if it gets that far.
Well, it certainly does look like the U.S. agreed to go along in exchange for getting a big arms deal. I mean, I hate to say it, it looks like we got bought. But the other thing is
Part of the U.S. establishment, probably, yes. But I have a hard time believing that that would be that simple.
Right. I agree. It can't, you know, if you look at our interests, they're too, as you said, we have no, it is not to our interest to have Saudi Arabia move militarily against Qatar. Now, here's the question, though.
Absolutely not.
How is Qatar going to get food?
First of all, let's see how long this let's see how long it lasts. Secondly, they can get food. I mean, I can't imagine the Saudis seriously starting to intercept ships with food or aircraft. So far, aircrafts are flying through Iranian airspace. Obviously, Iran would have to play a role in here, and Iran cannot remain neutral to begin with because they're sharing an oil field. And the Persian Gulf with Qatar. So Iran will be under pressure to act, which again brings me to my suspicion that, you know, the one party that truly benefits from this is Israel.
Right.
And there's a number of signs indicating this. First of all, one of the pretexts is that Qatar supports terrorist groups, and suddenly we have Hamas listed there. Since when is Hamas a problem for Saudi Arabia? It makes absolutely no sense to me. Secondly, this is a way of forcing all the Arabs to follow the Saudi line, which Saudi Arabia being the objective key ally of the Israelis in almost everything, and Qatar being the closest Arab country in the Gulf, the closest to Iran, yet again it serves Israeli interests. I mean, however bad the situation will get, it's not going to get. It's not bad for Israel. All of this is very good for Israel. That's why the
right.
Cui bono to me points the finger straight at Israel.
Well, what we've got, again oversimplifying, is that we've got the Make Israel Great Again plan. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Making Israel again is not incompatible with the existence of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is not a priority for Israel.
Right.
The others that much suffer. First of all, the territory, obviously, is the Golan Heights in Syria. In terms of the political enemy, it's Iran. So there you see it. Everything lines up very nicely here.
Right. Well, what this comes down to is Iran can be the hegemon in the Middle East or Israel. And that's the way it's positioned. And Israel basically wants to be a world power, let alone be the hegemon in the Middle East. Is that fair to say? Would you
absolutely
agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's all been, for all these years, the real threat to Israel from Iran is not some imaginary, non-existing nuclear missiles raining down on Tel Aviv. The real threat is the model, the civilizational model, the economic power, and the cultural and religious appeal that the Iranian Republic has. They're a very powerful country, and Israel feels very. Israel is much much smaller, and the natural local superpower should be Iran, and that's why. But the two countries which are most threatened by Iran are, of course, Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Right. Right. Well. It's the same as you see in North Korea. You almost get the feeling that we're coming into World War One, and there are too many situations where, somebody doing something stupid, you can end up in a world war.
I don't see the situation in Qatar risking a world war yet. I don't think the Americans can allow it to get completely out of control. And it's not as long as the Russians and Americans are not, facing each other down like they do in Syria. I'm still more concerned about Syria and the consequences of that than the situation with Qatar. Qatar, I don't know where this is going to end, but I hope that there will be pressure gradually building up regionally and internationally to make the Saudis cool down. Because if they decided to actually attack, I think they're headed for disaster again.
I hate to say this, but let me disagree with you for a second. When the world looks at Syria, it's a little bit like the world looking at what is going on in the black neighborhoods and saying, oh, well, that's what happens in black neighborhoods. If it happens in Qatar, it's a little bit like it happening to Darien, Connecticut. And people saying, uh-oh, if it can happen to Darien, Connecticut, it can happen to me. Because if you look at the ownership, I mean, Qatar is the wealthiest country in the world, on a per capita basis, it's arguably the wealthiest.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you look at their, what their sovereign wealth fund owns, you're talking about moving in physically on a country that has very significant roles and responsibilities in the Middle East financial system, and which could echo out into the world. So I think in terms of whether it represents, as you said, the U.S. commitment to allies or what can now happen not just to poor people but to rich people, I think it could be very significant in terms of impact.
But if you allow me, then I'll flip your argument against you. Precisely
okay.
because Qatar is the rich neighborhood, if you want, precisely because Qatar has such a heavy financial footprint, there are major forces that are going to put down
right.
a lot of pressure to try to prevent that from getting out of hand. Like in a fancy white neighborhood, you don't want, shootouts, whereas nobody cares in the ghetto, right? Well,
right.
the problem is that, for instance, the Israelis have been regularly bombing in Syria and nobody cares. I don't think the Israelis are going to bomb anybody in Qatar or Saudi Arabia, because that's not a place you can do it. Likewise, the Americans and the Russians are painting each other with radars now in Syria. They're nose to nose. there are no Russians around Qatar at all. And so the risk of something rapidly escalating or becoming truly dangerous is not as high. So precisely, right. I think Qatar is protected to some degree by having that immense wealth and having, there are people right now as we speak on the phone making all sorts of telephone calls and saying, stop it, stop it, stop it. We can't afford that. Right. I don't think anybody cares very much about Syria. That makes it so dangerous for Syria, precisely.
Right. Well, it's going to be a very interesting thing. Let me move on to the French elections, because the last time we talked to you, it was very much what was going to happen in France. So tell us your read on the French elections.
It's a total disaster, is my read, because you basically have Macron elected in an extremely complicated conditions. First of all, it's amazing that, you know, the first round of the elections, how little support he got, considering that he had the absolute support of the entire plutocracy in France and the entire powers that be, etc. They're all behind him. And then the French press did something very similar to what the American press did. They truly showed their real face. One of the major French magazines even had a full page, front page text saying, do whatever you want, but vote for Macron. So when you're getting at that level, the French did not have the wisdom, and I want to again compliment the American people for not voting for Hillary, even though the brainwashing was terrible. Well, the French did get brainwashed in sufficient numbers, and it brought Macron to power, which now he doesn't have a real political party. Some say he doesn't have a real political agenda. I'm not impressed by his level of competence at all. Things in France will just get worse. It's going to be Hollande version 2.0. And I'm extremely concerned about France in terms of violence, terrorism, social problems, economic problems. It's just it's more of the same. So it is an absolute disaster, I would say, for France. I feel very sorry for the French.
When I was in Europe, I ran into so many people who were very excited about the gentleman who didn't make it to the final round. His name is Le Marcheron. I probably
Mélenchon, yeah.
Mélenchon. Yeah.
Yeah, Mélenchon.
So,
I wasn't very, I don't have anything good to say about him either.
Okay.
To be honest, I don't really like Marine Le Pen either. So I think all the candidates were actually pretty bad.
Really?
Yeah. And Mélenchon, I think, is a pretty bad one, too. I mean, he's a semi-Trotskyite, basically having the same agenda, the globalist agenda, and open borders, and not take action on immigration. So I don't think
really?
They presented a viable option. I mean, none of them did. I don't think Marine Le Pen, I think she was the better alternative. But you have to see how extreme that is. I mean, as you know, in the sacred community, we have people ranging from monarchists to communists. I mean, we have pretty much everything, and I'm corresponding with all of them. I had communist friends in France who were telling me they're going to vote Marine Le Pen because that's the only patriotic thing to do for them. Mélenchon was so bad that communists were actually willing to vote Le Pen. I mean, if you know anything about France, it tells you how deep the crisis is. So in a way, I would say there are very similarities between the U.S. and France right now, except for in the U.S., Trump won, and in France, Mélenchon won. But somewhere in terms of the elites fighting their own people, there's the same dynamic at work.
Right, and there's also an inability to recognize the need to address economic productivity at a root level, bottom up. So, what I see in Europe...
Absolutely.
It was what I saw in Europe when I was the last two times I've been there is there's the same frustration. There's a myth that the people who elected Trump were working class. It's not true. What elected Trump were people who are required to get up every day and go out and make the economy work. And, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're engineers, they're people who are responsible for putting real meat on the bone in terms of the economy, and they are so frustrated with the idea of micromanaging everything by rules from Washington or the UN that they're ready to just tear their hair out. And it's got nothing to do with political philosophy. It's got to do with, you know, practicality versus centralized rulemaking and harvesting. So to me, this...
I absolutely agree with that.
You know, it's interesting, the refusal of America to deal effectively with the productivity issues, their failure is different than the French, but the French have also failed at that. And part of it is what the, you know, what the pro-centralization team wants is something that harvests the productivity as opposed to optimizes the productivity, and that's part of the problem at the root.
About the French and the Americans, yes, I agree with that. It's definitely the comparison of over-regulation from the federal government and the EU, but I think there's something even deeper taking place. I think in America, the people that voted for Trump, I would summarize them in a sentence which would go, we want our country back. And
right.
I think we see the same thing in France. I wouldn't call them nationalists or patriots, but there are people who say, you know, the model that is presented to us of is so unacceptable that this is not about politics, it's about to get our country back. And I think in France they're going to be denied that. I mean, Macron from that point of view is an absolute disaster. So it's going to be, you know, integration into Europe further and deeper and worse. And the United States, at least the anti... globalist, I would say, candidate, won. The problem is the United States, then a coup happened against them. So we have a situation, I think, in both countries where one by means of election, the second one by means of a coup. I think most people are from all classes, ranging from the wealthy to the poor, various, you know, regionalism, etc. They basically want their country back, and they're realizing that they're ruled by an elite who's never going to give them any say. And I think that makes both countries potentially explosive, because if you think about it deeply, this is a failure of democracy in both cases. In the United States, democracy failed by means of a coup, and in France, democracy failed by means of manipulation. But in both cases, there's clearly people power is not being... the system that's present now in the U.S. and France does not result in the will of the people being you know, expressed by their rulers.
Right, and the thing that disturbs me the most is the leadership is not listening to, in other words, there are areas where there could be agreement, and the leadership is simply not hearing, not listening, and not taking advantage of the feedback. In other words, it doesn't have to be this sort of win-lose. There are areas where you could have more agreement, but the leadership, it's almost as though the leadership has gotten stupid and greedy around the way things have gone for the last 20 years.
Well, I'm not sure about stupid. Greedy, definitely, but stupid, I mean, they're still winning. And the puppets that we have in power in both countries are very much listening and attuned to what the plutocracy tells them. So just as the loyalty are elsewhere, but in terms of, I don't think Hillary Clinton or Macron were people who are just plain stupid and not, you know, skillfully serving somebody's agenda. I think it's more of, I would compare it more to an occupation of a country, to a foreign occupation that has its own interests, than speaking of stupidity, because they did a very good job. I mean, in both countries, they're prevailing right now. Sad to say, but they are.
Right, right. Well, but I think, I'll use Clinton as an example. I think Clinton ran a terrible campaign and made some pretty horrendous mistakes that really do come from stupidity. So the deplorables comment was an enormous mistake, mm-hmm. and reflects... I mean, I think if you read... I just finished reading this new book, Shattered, about the Clinton campaign... I just think the campaign reflected a real stupidity about what it was going to take to win the election, and a very close-minded culture around, In other words, they were so used to getting things rigged for them that they forgot to pay attention and listen to certain things.
I think there's also a part of, first of all, I would agree with you that Hillary was a much worse candidate than Macron. Macron is actually a good puppet, though his campaign was also weak. I mean, it was nothing very inspiring, but at least he wasn't hated as much as Hillary. But I think that Hillary, she had an limitless amount of incompetence and arrogance, particularly. I mean, and particularly running against Trump, they could not ever conceive in their self, worshipping arrogance, that the people could choose Trump over, Hillary, and they did. Hence their hysterical reaction against him. It was an affront. It was a slap in the face from the people to the elites. So, yeah, I would agree with you. Hillary really blew it. I think if they had put Sanders up, he would have won, probably.
Oh, Sanders would have won. I absolutely agree with you. Now, one of the things that amazed me is as soon as Macron wins, he invites Putin to Paris and has no problem getting together with Putin. So the establishment is literally pushing Macron and Putin together while they're doing everything they can to keep, Tillerson and Trump away from Putin. It's kind of interesting.
Well, what's happening here is, first of all, the Europeans are horrified by the Americans, and they start to realize, it's starting to dawn upon them, and it's high time, that the Americans will solve nothing in Europe for them, and particularly not the Ukrainian crisis. Also, Macron desperately needs to get some kind of credibility, so meeting with a big guy like Putin, put some hair on his chest and makes him look more professional. At least superficially. I mean, I'm thoroughly unimpressed by his entire interaction with the Russians, but it gives him a visibility immediately because he has parliamentary elections that he's going to have to win. He's looking at establishing political credibility. As for the Russians, of course they would talk to him, see what he has to say, but France is not the powerhouse of Europe, it's Germany. Secondly, Macron doesn't have a strong base in parliament or in the people, so he's a weak leader right now. It's an attempt to explore, maybe he could get something done with the Russians, precisely because there's a rift happening between the U.S. and Europe right now, which we saw clearly during Trump's trip to Europe, to NATO, and to the G7, where he treated Europeans with complete contempt, wasn't even hiding it. The Europeans felt that, and they are feeling lonely now because they realize that they stuck their neck out for an ally who's absolutely not interested in them.
Well, you had a fabulous article on Trump's trip to Europe and on how extraordinary his behavior was, and you inspired me with that article to go take a look at some of the videos. And I have to tell you, it was absolutely, you're just scratching your head. What in the world was going on? So let's turn to Trump's trip to the G7 meeting and the meeting with the Vatican, because I have a couple of theories, and I just want to, I'll engage in a little bit of speculation, but first describe your wonderful article, because it was quite astonishing.
It was absolutely astonishing. We had American diplomats like, James Baker was, the refined gentleman and the perfect diplomat. Then we had the level of Obama, a car salesman, but still a charming man who knew how to smile, etc. And suddenly Trump showed up, and he was just plain rude and not making even an effort. I mean, he didn't fail at being polite. He just didn't even try. I am convinced he did it totally deliberately. And I think it was his way. First of all, he knew that all the Europeans were against him, so he wasn't exactly, feeling warm in his heart for them. But secondly, I think that Trump really sees the Europeans with a great deal of contempt, and I can't blame him for it. I mean, the Europeans, you are not going to be respected if you have no respect for yourself. And the Europeans have behaved in such a disgraceful way over the past, 10 years or whatever, that I think that a guy like Trump just looks at them. I wrote in my article that I think that Trump has much more respect for the leader of North Korea than he has for Merkel. And I understand him, because at least, the leader of North Korea has, some real power in his country. And then, he's struggling in a difficult situation, whereas the Europeans are simply all pathetic. And I think the Europeans were horrified by that because they felt it as a slap in their face, and that's exactly what it was. Hence, we see suddenly Merkel saying, you know, oh, maybe we need to. Macron said there's no major problem that cannot be solved without Russia participating, and Merkel starts saying, you know, we have to act independently. I mean, they didn't really openly. They didn't admit the depth of the alienation, but they couldn't help it. They still indicated it left and right that somehow they need to now almost unite against the Americans, which is not going to happen, of course. These are empty threats. America runs Europe, and the Europeans can do nothing about it. So I think Trump sent them that message, like, you are just, you know, little servants to me.
Well, it was almost as though Trump was saying, look, you're riding us on NATO, and while you're riding us on NATO and not paying your share, you know, our markets are open to you, and you're selling tons of cars, and, you know, you're playing us financially. You know, to him, it was, you're looking at a partner who's not paying their share of the overhead, but they're, you know, they're skimming the revenues. I mean, he approached the whole thing like a financial transaction.
Yes, but look at the way he treated the Chinese. He had the same kind of, he had the same similar, resentment against the Chinese, but he treated them with respect. He didn't allow himself to act in such a, you know, brutish way like he did here.
Right.
Because I think he has no contempt for the Chinese. I think he has contempt for the Europeans.
Right. Right, but what's the source of that contempt? Just that they're not a principle? You know, they're pretty much staff and not principal, or is it something else?
Well, Europe doesn't exist in terms of foreign policy. I mean, the dream of General de Gaulle of having, you know, a Europe of strong countries being a bridge between East and West, Europe had a fantastic potential. But I think partially there's a mix of things happening here, but basically the United States imposed a specific kind of political order, a vision of the EU, which was not the original European one, which turned the EU into an instrument of American foreign policy. I mean, the EU should never have moved NATO to the east, should never accept the Central Eastern European countries, and they did everything as they were told, and including this disaster in the Ukraine, which the Europeans should absolutely have prevented. But even that they didn't do, and they imposed sanctions that hurt them more than Russia, and I think, I mean, I'm sorry to use that term, but they acted like prostitutes, and nobody respects prostitutes. I mean, Trump is, at least Obama had, you know, the training to still pretend to respect them. I don't think he respected them very much. As Trump, he's a straightforward guy. He shows his contempt for prostitutes. I really think it's on that level, because who in Europe would he possibly respect? I couldn't name a single person.
London. He would respect London. And so
London for losing the Brexit referendum?
No, London because of the special relationship. London because of all sorts of ties, including on the intelligence side. So I think he would.
Yeah, that looks, you know, even here there are problems. The British have accused Americans of leading classified information about terrorism. I mean, even here there are cracks. And frankly, Britain is not really part of of Europe anymore, and really never has been.
Right.
I'm talking about the core group who thought they were so important, i.e. the French, the Germans. That's the duo there.
Well, one thing, and you've written this, and I think it's absolutely true, is Trump just has no interest in the Ukraine whatsoever, and his attitude is, it's your problem, fix it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think it's a correct decision on his part, because he politically can't really backpedal. You know, it would make him look really bad if he suddenly decided to, you know, side with the Nova Russians. But practically speaking, the real what's coming at us now, I mean, us, the world, is that somebody will have to pay for the Ukrainian mess. And it's going to be extraordinarily expensive. And the Russians will never do it. They won't, they don't want to do it, and they cannot do it. So the Americans are far away. It's going to be the Europeans. And Trump knows that. And he sort of said, you know, it's a mess. What the Americans really wanted in the Ukraine, they didn't get, which is Crimea, first of all, and secondly, you know, an anti-Russian Ukraine that would be viable. these were the two main objectives that the United States pursued in the Ukraine, and they failed at both. They semi-succeeded in making the Russians pay for the intervention in Syria by creating a zone of instability and concern on the Russian border. So I would say, to the degree that punishing the Russians was part of the calculation, that they succeeded, but now it's done. There's nothing else left for the Americans to take. Crimea will never go back to anybody, and the Ukraine is not viable. So they know it's essentially a stillborn baby, and they don't need it. So they're not going to, just they're going to ignore it. They'll do nothing about it. And I think actually, right, from the American point of view, this is a sound policy. I can't argue with that either.
Right. Right. Now, one of the things I wanted to bring up to you was we had Comey go to the Five Eyes meeting down in New Zealand, come back, and then within a short order be suddenly fired in a firing that was held very tightly. You know, there were no leaks before. Even Comey was surprised. Mm-hmm. Then Trump goes to the G7 meeting, and the Secret Service refused to allow him to convoy in by car, and they insist on him not staying at the hotel, but staying at an Air Force base and helicoptering in. So, mm-hmm, unbelievable concerns about security in Italy. Then we see Trump go meet, I think, I can't remember if he met with the Vatican first before G7 or after, but if you look at the pictures, the Trump, the Pope looks literally like he's got steam coming out of his ear. And so I look at all of this and I say, you know, were they seriously concerned about, did they have a reason to be seriously concerned about security in Italy?
Well, I would say that in Italy, you always have serious reasons for concern. I mean, the kind of people that have been killed in Italy, you know, it is a dangerous place by definition. So, yeah, right. I mean, I wasn't aware of the fact that this helicopter thing, I didn't know about that, but I certainly would be concerned. A leader as controversial as Trump, and with all the forces aligned against him, I think he's in danger in the United States and abroad. He's in danger everywhere.
Right. Well, I don't know. It certainly looked to me like, then if you look at his behavior at the G7 meeting, I don't know, it looked to me like this was a man who had deep reasons to be concerned about the forces aligned against him. I don't know, something, you know, I'm just smelling something, so I'm curious. Now, one of the things we know he did was he announced that he was not committed to the Paris Accord and then canceled it when it got back. And one of the interesting things that happened, and Trump has done this in numerous occasions, there are lots of writers, you know, I never looked at the Paris Accord, honestly, because I didn't want to get upset. I knew, mm-hmm, I was going to go crazy. But one of the things that came out afterwards is now a lot of people are writing about it. And you had a structure on the Paris Accord, and the U.S. has pulled but says they're going to keep negotiating. But you had a structure that we've seen in many cases where you have a non-binding commitment to put in vast amounts of money that are going to go into a process where there's no clear definition of where the money's going and no performance metric, which is just the kind of thing that would drive an entrepreneur like Trump completely nuts. You know, everybody wants to know where every penny goes and what the performance metric are. And while Trump was announcing from when he returned that they were, U.S. was pulling out of the accord, you could see Gary Cohen, you know, who 2 months ago was the president of Goldman Sachs. I mean, he looked like he had ants in his pants. He kept turning around and looking at what other people were looking at. It was almost like he was waiting for the bullet to fly in. And then shortly thereafter, Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman of Goldman Sachs, who's been on Twitter for many years but has never put out a tweet, put out his first tweet dishing Trump for getting out of the accord. And literally what you're seeing is a global elite that was clearly planning on a vast amount of money going into this mechanism, whatever it was and wherever it went, and is suddenly having their plans thrown up in the air like a deck of cards that's suddenly being reshuffled. And so it's yet again this, I mean, from a financial standpoint, you're looking at a major hiccup in people's plans on the cash flows, same as Qatar. You know, from a financial standpoint, Qatar and the cancellation of the Paris Accord is, you know, sending shockwaves through the money.
But keep in mind that Trump has changed his positions on many things. Remember, he was telling that NATO is obsolete, and now NATO is not obsolete anymore. And he said he would negotiate the Paris Accords, and they're supposed to take another 2 years before they even started. So this might be, first of all, putting himself in a good bargaining position, see if he can get a better deal. And secondly, I am not at all so sure that he will resist the pressure over the next couple of years.
Oh, as we see, he can bow to pressure. Well, he can certainly bow to pressure from Israel. That we can say pretty clearly. So it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But he certainly, during the speech, he certainly made a big, you know, the catch line that the press picked up on is, "I represent the people of Pittsburgh, not Paris."
And that's really
a good one. It's a very good one, because if you look at how the money worked, you know, the taxpayers were putting the money in, but there was no performance metric as to how they would, you know, what the return would be and how it would connect. So, you know, it's kind of amazing that Obama sent $1 billion somewhere into that agreement without Senate approval. It's just, I mean, it's not constitutional from my standpoint.
No, okay. It's actually interesting to see that Trump, unlike Obama, who always had that, and Hillary, you know, that arrogance about nothing, they are irreplaceable, Trump is truly, clearly trying to deliver on some of his campaign promises, and I think make America great again, and partially, it's stop wasting money abroad, be it NATO or the Paris Accords, and I think the sentence about, you know, I represent Pittsburgh is a very good one.
Right.
You know, tells the, he's trying to tell the people, my loyalty are to your incomes.
Right, but when you see, so I'm looking at a process which has been run by lawyers who don't think about price. And, you know, in the world, something that costs 5 cents is productive, but not if it costs $5. And so, you know, most of these people, whether it's Obama or Clinton, you know, George W. Bush, they ran it as though money wasn't real. And Trump is running it as though money is real. And, you know, the cost of capital is more than free. And and that's a very deep shock to the globalist culture, because they're used to, you know, their money coming at a 0% cost of capital and taking as much as they want.
Yeah.
And that's part of what the productivity backlash is about. So, you know, and I think it's the thing that endears Trump, you know, to a lot of us. Anyway, let's turn to North Korea, because, as you said, North Korea is, I want to talk a little bit about Russia and North Korea, because North Korea, we've seen Mattis come out and say that, you know, talk very tough on North Korea. But the question is not what the United States wants. It seems to me you don't change the North Korean policies without Russia and China putting sufficient pressure on North Korea.
I certainly don't see Russia. I'm not so sure. I don't think Russia has much traction with North Korea, but the Chinese definitely do. And I think it's a difficult ally, I would say, of theirs, and difficult neighbor. But they clearly shown that they're not going to let, you know, the North Koreans are not alone. So you have to work through the Chinese to get something done in North Korea. But the problem is, how do you do that while at the same time alienating the Chinese? There again, we're in a situation where even the U.S. foreign policy contradicts itself. I mean, I mentioned on an interview with you, you know, cannot fight ISIS and alienate Iran. You cannot try to get something done in North Korea and alienate China. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
And even if the Russians had any traction there, which I don't think they do, but they're, you know, Trump also, I mean, the United States currently doesn't have many incentives for the Russians to help them with anything.
Right.
It's actually pretty ridiculous to think that the Russians would help. Why would they? So that's the problem of being overextended and finding everybody at the same time.
Right.
I don't see a systematic thought through foreign policy. Again, I know it sounds bizarre for speaking like that of a superpower, but I honestly am not discerning a goal-oriented, rational foreign policy.
So what would you do if you were president of the United States? What would you do with respect to North Korea? Would you allow it to continue to develop its nuclear arsenal?
Yes. Well, yeah, absolutely. Or if I didn't do that, I would try to entice it by offering it economic advantages to agree to a regime of monitoring. But the first thing would be to provide real guarantees and reassurance to the North Koreans. Bullying them that way only makes them more, determined to fight to the last nuke. And I don't think that's going to work, because behind them eventually there are the Chinese. So I would use incentives or accept the fact that certain countries will develop a nuclear technology. I don't think there's much of a threat, by the way, here. Because what people don't understand is that once you have a nuclear device, which is totally different from a nuclear weapon, you need to build a nuclear weapon, and once you have the nuclear weapon, you need to be able to use it intelligently. The North Koreans just wanted to nuke Seoul, they could do that with conventional artillery, achieve the same results. So it is true that further down the road, many years down the road, there is this possibility of a North Korean ICBM flying towards Hawaii or the United States. But that is a risk that's going to happen anyways. I mean, the Indians have it, the Pakistanis have it, everybody forgets about that, but there is already an Islamic nuclear weapon out there. The Israelis have it, and I wouldn't trust them one bit. Politics is a science of the possible. I would recommend generally that the U.S. withdraw from most areas in which it has no business solving local problems. Let the Chinese and the Russians deal with the North Korean issue. I can assure you that neither the Chinese nor the Russians have any need or use for a nuclear-armed DPRK. Let them settle it.
Right. Well, I'm assuming the reason the U.S. doesn't is the U.S. wants to be perceived as the hegemon globally, both in Asia and in Europe. So, and I think they feel if they withdraw and don't make this their business, then you're going to see all their allies in Asia basically look to China as the Asian hegemon. And that's a currency issue.
I agree with you completely, but the problem is that the United States does not have the means of such a policy. So when you try to play hegemon, but you can't deliver, you look even weaker.
Right.
I think that the inevitability is that the U.S. has to accept that it cannot be a world hegemon, that a multipolar world is going to happen, whether they like it or not. So the real question is, how do they negotiate a drawdown, a planetary drawdown, a withdrawal from that role of a global hegemon, and what is the best deal they can get while they still have some kind of leverage? That was my big hope with Trump, that he would do that. I was hoping that by making America great again, he would, draw down the Anglo-Zionist Empire and really concentrate on making the United States of America, I'm talking about the states themselves, who are in need of much help and much reform, etc., focus on them. But wasting resources and money on completely empty threats. Look at those three aircraft carrier battle groups that he sent to off the coast of North Korea.
Right.
And then what? Nothing happened. It's an empty threat.
Right.
It's a hollow threat.
Right.
So that makes
you
even weaker. That's a big problem.
Right.
Posturing.
Right, and that's expensive posturing. It's very expensive posturing.
Extremely expensive. And dangerous on top of that. Very dangerous posturing.
Right, well, here's the thing. There's a conflict between the Make America Great Again plan and the Make Israel Great Again plan. That's what we're watching.
Yeah, except for I'm not sure that's that simple, because it's a guess more than a certitude, but I don't think the Israelis are really running the show either. I think there's a transnational gang of people based in the United States and Israel who are using both countries for their own power and advantage. But frankly, looking at the past years, I mean, are the U.S. policies really helping the Israeli people? If we say that it's the Israelis that are in control of it, it makes it sound like Israeli patriots are using the United States for their own, for the benefit of the Israeli people. But that's not happening either. They're not doing well at all.
I see two things happening.
It's a pretext.
Right. If you go back to what the neocons are up to, you're looking at two things. You have an economic model which is vested in making sure you have, you know, superior enforcement capability in many places. So it makes no sense to send significant troops back into Afghanistan, but I'm sure you've got $1 trillion of mining interests, including lithium, and all sorts of corporate interests screaming about wanting to make sure that that's available and secure to them. So so you've got global economic interests who are all screaming for enforcement capacity to protect their access to those, whether it's access to natural resources or markets or whatever. And the reality is the corporate balance sheets are ballooning while the federal government balance sheet is a mess, and the federal balance sheet can't afford to keep the game going, but those corporate interests want the game going. So whether you've got the transnational gang or the corporate interests, the pressures are enormous to continue to do what, and that's why I was focused on the Paris Accord. You have all these different activities that cost the taxpayers money and make money for private investment or corporate interests, and you've basically run down the federal balance sheet, ballooning these other interests, and they want the game to continue. But the problem is you're starting to run into real, implosion on the federal, whether it's the military capacity or the financial capacity. And Trump's in the middle of saying, wait a minute, and, that's not what the corporate interests want to hear. That's what it looks like to me. And the Israeli game is all in the middle of that. The neocon game is all in the middle of that. And part of my saying that there's not, the elites aren't listening is, it's not that they're not listening to the people. It's that they're not listening to the operational concerns of the line management that's saying, wait a minute, we can't deliver what you want and need. We're spread too thin and this is not working. In other words, it's an operational and engineering problem coming out of a deep financial systemic flaw. It's not ideology. It's not, oh, you're being cruel to the people. There's a real disconnect between the leadership at the top and the line management who's got to deliver.
But do you think the line management actually speaks back and raises the alarm the way you describe it?
I think that alarm, no. I don't think they just speak back clearly and openly. But I think if you look at the pushback that's coming, what I call the productivity backlash, it very much represents their screams. So I think if you go in and you look deeply at the DoD financials, you can estimate out what is happening because so in fiscal 2015, $6.5 trillion went missing at the Department of Defense. And I assure you that money did not nourish and enrich the operational things that the U.S. Navy and the U.S. military needs to provide what it is whether the corporations need or the neocons want or, whatever the group is, and meantime, the defense contractors are just happy to make sales. But the reality is, they're dancing on a platform which is overextended and in real trouble. And that's what Trump sees. Now, if you look at his budget didn't make any sense in the sense, or his budget proposal, that he's not talking about how you reinvent the military presence globally for a new vision of America, in the world we're going into. They basically
that's
stalled and
true.
Said, right, we're going to solve the spread thin by throwing more money at the military, and we won't worry about re-engineering anything or modernizing it, or streamlining it. We'll worry about that later. You know, in the meantime, you can just hope that Mattis and the group at Department of Defense are figuring out how to reinvent the whole thing, because, you know, you can't just solve this problem by throwing more money at it. But that basically that's what Trump is doing right now. So there's a
exactly. I completely agree with you.
Right. So there's this huge conundrum that you know that emerges when you look at the budget, because you know the whole thing does not make economic sense, whether you're looking at an integrated economy or just the official reality, and it's going to have to make sense one way or the other.
And it makes absolutely no military sense either, I can tell you that. The U.S.
Right.
military is getting weaker and weaker because it's getting very little in terms of what it actually needs. But it
right.
most certainly lacks is now some kind of vision, because if you accept the fact that it's overstretched and cannot, that being the world hegemon is unsustainable, the next logical step from a force planning point of view is to design some kind of strategy which is commensurate with your actual means. So you draw down essentially, but you make your priorities and you decide on a new strategic course, which then influences force planning, strategy, and politics. And that debate is absolutely
right.
not happening. I mean, when I listen to Mattis, I don't know if I want to laugh or cry. It's pathetic. This man is absolutely pathetic. He has no vision whatsoever. And all of them, actually. I mean, you listen to this, what's coming out of the Pentagon right now. It's complete delusional. They don't realize that what's needed is a fundamental shift, a profound fundamental shift, you know, and rethinking of American national strategies. And it's not there, unfortunately. It's all about
well,
money.
It was really interesting. One of the books we recommended for the, you know, in our annual wrap-up, we recommend books for the year to read. And one was a book called The New Grand Strategy, written by three gentlemen. And the history of it was... one or two of them worked for Mike Mullen when he was the chief of staff, and
yep.
And when he came in, and we said, okay, we need a new vision for the military. You know, the world's changing. We need a new vision. And he said, but our vision has to serve the greater civilian political vision. And so he went to the White House to try and find out what it was, and there was nothing. And so
essentially,
to get one for the military, they had to, you know, try and, you know, intuit one for the whole country. And so these guys worked on it. And then when they left the military, they teamed up with an academic and went into universities and think tanks and kept working on the vision. And actually, it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty decent effort at trying to reinvent everything. And but by mm-hmm. reading it, what you realize is, you know, I'm a great admirer of looking at all the Chinese plans. You know, the Chinese have a plan for everything. And they really go through a very serious planning process is remarkably open and engages a wide number of participants. And, they're, you know, this is pretty serious stuff. And they got, you know, and it's funny, my personal experience with the leadership in America is they got a 100-year plan, a 50-year plan, but it's all secret and in secret societies. You know, it's all out at the Bohemian Grove. So, you know, in the meantime, America is, if you look at the budget is literally being destroyed by the absence of a plan. And so it seems to me if the Chinese can create an overt plan, so can we. But that's what the military, if you're going to re-engineer the budget, you've got to re-engineer the military role. And if you're going to do that, you got to you got to have a grand national strategy. And as rudimentary and crude as Trump is, it looks to me like he's trying to, you know, he was trying to create a domestic one. Now he's trying to he's trying to figure out how to create a global one. And he's being forced to understand the budget because, you know, back to the budget again, if you look at what's going on in Washington, you know, the Congress said tax reform, no money, infrastructure, no money, healthcare, no money. Okay, let's do witch hunting. That doesn't require any money, so and the people find it entertaining. So let's stick to witch hunting and not do tax reform, health reform, or infrastructure. You know,
let me tell you this. Speaking of strategy and how you know there's a way of thinking about it differently. Let me ask you this question. What would happen if overnight you wave a little magic wand and the entire U.S. military disappears? I mean, gone. The people, the infrastructure, everything just vanishes into thin air. What happens to the rest of the planet? Is there some really bad consequence happening? And I personally tell you immediately, I don't think it would be that bad for the rest of mankind. And I don't even think it would be that bad for the United States, to be honest. I mean, it's a little bit of a caricature. I'm simplifying things. There are things that could be wrong, etc. But I really think that the way to look for a new strategy is starting in that extreme of a position. You know, do we need a military? What's its purpose? What kind of foreign policy do we want? Do we want to have alliances, or do we just want to have, you know, good relations with everybody but no alliances with anybody? I mean, these fundamental core questions need to be asked before you start then building the allocating the resources to building the means to get it done. And as long as they don't do that, they're going to do what they've been doing all these years, which is more of the same, only worse, doubling down with the worst possible strategy.
Right. Well, when I said no, right now you have most aspects of institutional America absolutely committed to the military because they want to remain the reserve currency, and not basically looking at a very abrupt coming off of the dollar. In other words, there's no replacement currency. In other words, what if you don't have the dollar as reserve currency? What are you going to use? And so, and in the meantime, you have lots of interest in the financial system that don't want an abrupt end. You know, they'd rather have a phased, if you look at what's happening to the dollar, you're basically slowly phasing it out. But it's what the economists called it, dangerous and dominant. And so the world wants to slowly phase it out as they build up other alternatives and build up a much more multipolar transactional infrastructure, which is going to take years to do. So I think that's one of the pressures. But the other thing is, you've created a military-industrial complex, which is deeply, deeply economically dependent on pretending to have enemies, and they've got the bit in their teeth. And I think that the question is, how can you, you know, you've got to find a way to evolve the economic model, because, you know, the whole stock market at this point needs war, and there are no enemies.
Okay, but realize one thing, that I completely agree with you. You mentioned three aspects. First of all, you mentioned that the entire country is basically working for the military. That's an economic aspect. You mentioned the dollar, which I agree with you, needs to be, everybody wants to phase it out pretty gradually. And then you mentioned also the economic reform inside the country. All these things, these are the questions that pop up in somebody's mind if you put the extreme question out. So you begin by saying, what if the military disappeared overnight? That immediately triggers that kind of questions, and these questions are where it's really happening, where it should be looked at. So it's just a thought experiment. And my suggestion is that, of course, I mean, if I was the president, I would not shut down the entire military overnight, but I would say, here are our priorities, and then how do we make that transition as painless as possible for our country and our people? So if you manage the transition, you can get a fairly soft landing. And actually, I would argue that a lot of countries out there would be willing to assist the United States, because nobody benefits from a cataclysmic breakdown.
Right.
But what they're doing right now is the polar opposite. They're doubling down, they're being completely delusional, and they're essentially creating the worst possible outcome for the United States by not asking these fundamental questions.
Right. Although I will say this, I think since Trump has been elected, no one in the United States has ever inspired more consciousness about the importance of getting as quickly as possible to a multipolar world as the Americans have in the last couple months. It's quite remarkable. I think, you know, in terms of creating multipolar payment and transactional mechanisms, I think a great deal of, you know, it's very hard and complicated to do that, But I would dare say the Americans have inspired an incredible effort over the last 6 months. So, you know, and that's going to happen very quietly.
If you want to be credible by that in that kind of fields, the first thing is to respect the rule of law. Right. That makes you predictable. That makes outcomes predictable and manageable.
Right.
You can't at the same time trying to go to a multinational system and brazenly violate international law the way Trump has done over and over and over again. I mean, he done it in Syria. He's doing it now indirectly through the Saudis and the Qatari situation. He done it because threatening war. Or what he did with North Korea, I think, is another violation of international law. By basically the very first step, the United States really wanted to go in a process of discussing a multipolar world. The first axiomatic statement, like a statement of intention, would be, from now on, we will abide by international law and treaties. Just that statement would bring so much predictability back into the system that would make it possible for people to work with the United States again.
But the U.S. hasn't respected the rule of law for decades.
Yes, but it got particularly bad since 1991, because in the past there was a real perceptible immediate danger of not respecting it. But it all began in with Yugoslavia. I think that's where it first really went south, badly.
Right.
And we're still paying the consequences of that terrible mistake.
Right. I don't see Trump as being less respectful of international law than Obama or Bush.
No, I think he's worse than Bush. Obama pretty much on par, and I would say worse than Bush.
Really?
But it's not even Trump. What's really, really frightens me is the deafening silence around...
I mean, Bush declared war on Afghanistan when Afghanistan hadn't done a thing. Then he declared war in Iraq. They haven't done a thing.
True. But the pretext for war was 9/11, which, as you know, I think was not done by the Saudis, or I think it was basically an inside job, a controlled demolition by the deep state. But the pretext was there, and you could say it to the rest of the world, you could elicit a great deal of sympathy. If you want, you bought yourself a ticket out of jail like at a Monopoly, by saying what was done to us was so grievous that we'll sort of, skirt international law, going a little bit around it. But where it was brazen, truly, it was with the attack on Yugoslavia, which was no justification whatsoever for it, other than wanting to beat up somebody, preferably Orthodox, preferably allied to Russia. And then all the color revolutions that happened, and now this constant striking in Syria, and nobody objects to it. It's amazing. I look at the press, be it, you know, the official one or the so-called blogosphere alternative media, very few people say everything we're doing there is a violation of international law, which should land us in jail. I mean, Trump already is a war criminal.
Everything we're doing in Syria is in violation of international law, but everything we're doing in Yemen is in international law. To me, everything we're doing in Afghanistan is in violation of international law. You know, it goes on and on and on. Now, perfect. Let me turn to Duterte and the Philippines, speaking of international law, because I find what's going on in the Philippines to be both very interesting and very relevant. And that is, you have essentially a former mayor, very experienced, running the country, very high popular support, who's basically created a bounty hunter system to get rid of the drugs, and it's working. It's, you know, it's really cleaning up the drug problem, and he's done a very eloquent job of explaining why drugs are so horrible to the people. You know, basically, I'm a couple, my one asset, I have kids, and if those kids get caught up in drugs and destroyed by the drug business, you know, it destroys the family wealth, so to speak. And so he's successful at doing it, and who should turn up to defend the drug business but ISIS? Now, how did ISIS get all the way to the Philippines?
Well, they've always been present, or proto-ISIS, not called ISIS yet, has always been present in the region, be it in Indonesia or in the Philippines. I mean, there's a presence of what's commonly called Islamist extremists in the region for a very, very long while.
Right.
And the way they usually do is they take some kind of grievance and inject themselves into it. Any kind of conflict is something they can inject themselves into.
Right. Well, unless they're...
So I'm personally not surprised that it would get involved in that way at all.
Are they defending the market share? In other words, if you look at the cash flows coming off of the drugs, and those cash flows diminish, you know, are they basically working for the people who are angry their cash flows are diminishing? Is there a connection?
I don't know that for a fact. I wouldn't say it's impossible. There have been other strange alliances, for instance, in Peru and other places, and certainly in, by the way, in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. I mean, there have been moments where so-called Islamic fundamentalists, which is a misnomer, I think, were working together with drug dealers. But I don't know that for a fact for the Philippines, so I don't have an opinion on that.
Right. Well, now we see Duterte talk with Trump and the entire transcript verbatim leaked to the media. And, you know, you've had we've now basically had 6 months of everything Trump says to foreign leaders leaked to the media, which to me has got to be this has to be a felony. It has to be a nonstop felony. The President of the United States can't talk to a foreign leader without it being leaked to the press. You know, it's interesting, a group of Republicans have just announced that they're considering not reauthorizing some of the surveillance powers, basically saying the intelligence agencies can't be trusted with this information.
Look, Trump has been constantly betrayed, and there are felony after felony after crime committed against him by the deep state. I mean, the fight has not slowed down one bit. They're still out there to get him. I still think they want to impeach him. And they're going to stop at nothing. They will leak that. They will make up parts of the transcripts. I mean, I think they even accused Lavrov of bringing in some bug on a present, some listening device, something like this. I mean, it's totally insane. I mean, it would be really laughable if it wasn't scary.
Right. It was funny. I don't know if you saw Putin's interview with Megyn Kelly, and then another interview
only parts.
I guess he did with him. Yeah, but... That's, to me, the scariest thing. If you look at anyone globally trying to deal with the United States, you have the fluidity of the policies, the inability to commit and keep the international law, and now you've got, you know, you can't even talk to them without stuff being leaked or made up. And so, you know, the way we're going to move to a multipolar world, it's going to be like a, you know how a herd of cows moves away from the sick one, you know, and the cows steadily, steadily move away from the sick one. Right. So all these different dynamics, I mean, is forcing everybody to move away from the crazy one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During that interview, I didn't see it all. I saw excerpts of it, of course. The people in the room were laughing at her stupidity and the ridiculous. She's back over and over again with those stupid accusations. And it does really give a terrible image of the United States abroad. I absolutely agree with you.
Right.
It makes the United States look a pariah, basically a complete idiot, a sewer power run by idiots. And that's extremely damaging because, and I think I mentioned that in a past conversation with you, is that it's scary when a system promotes the most mediocre and incompetent people and actually keeps down the most brilliant and competent people. I mean, you'll never make me believe that Megyn Kelly is the best the United States can do in terms of journalists. I mean, never.
No, but here's what I realized watching it. And I've never watched Megyn Kelly. I don't even own a TV. So, you know, I only see her occasionally on the YouTube interviews. But here's what I realized. You know, the Joseph Farrell's comment about the world, you know, Bach wrote on a 26-track, but Americans listen to the drumbeat, which is one or two tracks. and the multipolar world functions on 20. Yeah, it's a brilliant sort of analysis, and he says, you know, the world functions on 26 tracks, but Americans are trying to function on two tracks and understand the world on two tracks and interact with the world on two tracks, and the reality is it's not a two-track world, it's a 26-track world. And it was very interesting watching Megyn Kelly during that interview. What you realized, if Megyn Kelly had been operating in a 26-track culture starting 10 years ago, you know, she would have been able to do a good interview. But she's functioned in a two-track world where the propaganda is trying to market a two-track story and keep everything in sort of an official two-track vision of the world. And when she lands in St. Petersburg and has to operate on 26 tracks, she literally cannot do it. And what you realize
is... I agree completely.
She has absolutely no understanding of what's really going on. She's absolutely
lost.
She
doesn't. I don't think Nikki Haley has any understanding. The State Department spokespeople have no understanding. I mean, all the people that are visible and upfront that represent the United States are the worst that this country can...
Oh, I have to disagree with you. Rex Tillerson is on 26 tracks. Now, he may talk two tracks, you know, when he gets on CBS because he's dealing in a two-track model, but Rex Tillerson operates on 26 tracks. So
that's possible. I wouldn't argue with that.
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw his press conference. One of our top picks for the second quarter is the press conference he did with Lavrov, which was one of the greatest. It was very short, but basically what happened was Andrea Mitchell asked them a question about Comey, and Lavrov and Tillerson like each other. And they were very eager to get in the room and keep talking about serious matters. So Andrea Mitchell says to Lavrov, "Did you hear Comey was fired? What do you think?" And Lavrov and looked at her like, you know, we are adults. We are here doing serious business. You children need to go play with your toys elsewhere. And they rolled their eyes.
I had the same impression.
And they treated her with a disdain. I have never seen a foreign minister of that status, let alone a secretary of state, treat a senior member of the U.S. press corps with that disdain. They just laughed at her openly in front of everybody and rolled their eyes and walked away. They just turned their backs and walked away. And it was, I can't think of any behavior that could show more disrespect. And of course, it was 150% deserved. So now, I don't know if you realize this. Andrea Mitchell is Alan Greenspan's wife. And, you know, if there is any human being on this planet that got us into this mess, it's Alan Greenspan. So the fact that Lavrov and Tillerson are, you know, I had a very high opinion of both of them before that, but they, you know, they skyrocketed to hero status. As a result,
I completely agree with you about Tillerson, and I would say this is the only ray of hope and the only positive development recently. I was extremely happy with his trip to Moscow, and then he invited Lavrov over to the White House. And basically, yeah, I agree with you. Tillerson is the one guy that we can still hope, God willing, he'll be able to make a difference. I agree with you. He's not at all a mediocre personality. And he comes across as credible, and Lavrov clearly enjoyed working with him, as apparently did Putin, because he spent a lot of time with him.
Right.
So well, there was adult talk taking place, finally, between the two countries.
Right, and there are other people in the cabinet who I think are capable. So, and I think Trump is capable of learning. The problem is he swings back and forth between giving the unipolar vision what it wants and doing something sensible, you know, domestically. So we'll just have to see how it seesaws out. But I do think certainly the crazy making result to allies is forcing everybody to to go evolve into that multipolar world. So
Tillerson is still an outsider, though. He doesn't have the connections and the career to tackle the Pentagon, the CIA, and the deep state. That's my concern, is that they're going to act without, you know, did Tillerson, was he consulted before the latest airstrike in Syria? There's the danger that, you know, Tillerson might try to run a mentally sane State Department, but the Pentagon will basically ignore and run a parallel foreign policy, as does the CIA.
Right. Right. Well, your danger here is you're going to have not one United States, you're going to have multiple personality disorder. There was one point during Obama when I was convinced that you had the Pentagon supporting one group in Syria and the CIA supporting a different group in Syria.
Yep.
And
me
basically,
too.
You had.
I'm absolutely convinced.
Right. You basic, and I think that's your problem here. You're going to have such a fractionalization of the U.S. government, and you're going to have multiple power centers, and there's going to be no coordination. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons I think Flynn was moved out was they were hoping they could move somebody who could really coordinate, but McMaster can't do it. So, you know, that's going to be the danger. And that's why I keep coming back to the budget, because all these policies are ultimately are going to be driven by who gets what money.
Yep. Absolutely.
Right. Well, we got one question, which was a very, and I won't read the whole thing. I sent it to you, but essentially what they said was, you know, was a global version of the question I asked during the election. If America has a negative return on investment, do we really want to make America great again? Won't the world be better off if America doesn't become great again? So I have a lot of thoughts about that, but I wanted to start by asking you, because they specifically said, would you ask the Saker what he thinks of this? So why don't you take the first crack at that?
Okay, well, it all depends what you mean by America and by great. As usually it's in the words, that's the key thing here is. I think that America is not great when it is the host for an Anglo-Zionist empire. I think it's enslaved. I think it's occupied. So if, to me, you know, my understanding of what I would wish to see if we speak about America becoming great again is America owned by its people, will have a government that represents the interests, you know, gets, as a person recently wrote to me, we want our country back. I think that if America became sovereign again, truly sovereign, that would be a form of greatness that would be welcomed by a lot of people. And secondly, I think that America great also means taking care of the American people, simply, literally, putting the priorities here of maximizing the welfare of the people living here. Now, if we're talking about America as more of the same, and greatness is expressed by basically violence, subversion, and corruption, then God forbid that America should be as weak as and minute as possible, because in its current condition, unfortunately, it's a threat for all of mankind. But I think the good news from out of that is that the American people have the same interests as the people elsewhere. It's really, there's only one enemy, and that enemy is the same one for Trump as it is for Putin, as it is for all of us, and that's the enemy we need to tackle. And if America can do that, that would be another sign of greatness.
Right, right. I agree. You know, one way to look at it is because truly the stock market is captured by the military-industrial complex needs. We have America has 24% of the global GNP, but 50% of the stock market cap. So, you know, basically what you're looking at, the thing that translates that 24% into 50% is the military role. It wouldn't happen without the military, and I think that's part of the pressure on Trump, and Trump being a financial, you know, sort of, he's a real estate guy, but he's very financially oriented. One of the things you said is the rule of law. You cannot operate a healthy culture, let alone a healthy economy, without the rule of law. And
absolutely.
The United States, both internally and externally, has become increasingly lawless. My question in the first quarter wrap-up is, can a new administration maintain a prosperous economy without more debt, crime, and war? And I would say that the globe is now at a point where, you know, we're at a tipping point. We can't take more crime and war, and yet that seems to be where it's going. And it's been astonishing to me to see Putin become as powerful as he becomes. And truly, the thing that has really driven him to power, from what I can see, is he is so astute at using international law and using law to maintain and build his power. And as he's done that, we look increasingly lawless. And that's a box we're going to have to get out of, because our whole claim to fame was, you know, sort of was our ability to protect and defend a financial market and financial trade. And all of that depends on the rule of law. So there's a multiple personality disorder going on in the American presence in the world. And it can't maintain the liquidity unless it maintains the rule of law. And so the crime thing is going to have to back down, or we're going to set the world into a place of real serious trouble. Not that it isn't there already, but it could get much worse. So to me, it seems like we're approaching a tipping point.
I would say that the rule of law is also important, not only because indeed, you cannot run a healthy market and economy without rule of law, but all the other values that maybe not as a country that America stood for, but at least proclaimed. I mean, the First Amendment and all the other amendments, you know, civil rights, all these ideals, even the question, does the country need a standing army? If you look at the founding fathers and the ideas that were proclaimed at the foundation of these nations, I think they inspired a lot of people worldwide sincerely. And I think that is something that is worthy of respect, that people would, you know, support. Right now, the United States acts in a way that's completely contrary to its own philosophy. Yet again, it reminds me of the late period of communism in the Soviet Union, where officially communism was proclaimed and everybody knew that it was a farce and a joke. And now these values are not upheld anymore. And that, I think, is one thing that would make America great again, is to return to the values that, not necessarily to the policies of the past, because a lot of them are very bad, but to values proclaimed that make this country unique and that deserve to be, you know, re-proclaimed and re-centered as policies should be informed by values. They should be value-centered. Right. And it's not what's happening right now. Right now, it's all, you know, corruption and quick gain and money.
Well, here I think we're at a crossroads. We're either going to become a human we're going to stay a human civilization, or become inhuman. And there are too many forces in America that are basically promoting inhuman civilization, and the world sort of watching to see which one wins. And it's, to me, it looks completely up in the air, and that's why I think what's happening is, with the current administration, is so very important, because, you know, one day it's human, the next day it's inhuman, and the question is, you know, which one's going to win? And to me, I absolutely believe we should be working on Make America Great Again, because this is going to come down to every person doing whatever they can to ensure that we have a human society. And I think every time you see a country destroyed or fail in a bad way, it's very unhealthy. You know, the neocons believe that we can get to a good place by destroying things. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. So I will always be for whatever it is, I'm always for the Make It Great Again plan, as opposed to, oh, let's let it fail or be destroyed on the theory that things are going to be better as a result.
I agree with you. Destruction is the worst possible scenario, you know, or cataclysmic revolutions. But keep in mind that the rest of the world is not passive and just watching what's happening here. I mean, I am absolutely convinced that Russia and China are at war with the empire. And they are, and in that sense, the neocons are not wrong. They are sensing. I mean, we just had, who was it? McCain saying that Russia is more dangerous than ISIS. And in a way, he's right, because Russia, as a civilizational model, is at war with the Anglo-Zionist Empire. It's a war that's 80% informational, but it is a type of war, and only one of the two will walk away from this. So either going to be a multipolar world or a world hegemony, and I don't see any possibility for the empire to prevail. I think it's absolutely clear to me that it does not have the means to prevail, which only leaves two scenarios: a cataclysmic fall of the empire, possibly including an international nuclear war, or a more or less managed one. And that's what I hope and pray for, a more or less managed landing. A soft landing is the best for the planet and for the American people. A cataclysm would be the worst. But these are the two options. I don't see that system. I don't believe it's viable. I think it's much weaker than people think it is.
Well, here's the thing. If you look at the people who argue that success as a global empire is possible, I don't, you know, clearly you have factions who believe that it absolutely is. You know, but it will take many, many decades to realize. It's a long-term plan, and part of it is you know, working against Russia and letting demographics basically take Russia down. So Russia has two big weaknesses. One is the demographic decline, but the other is a real dependence on fossil fuel and certain commodities for its economy. And if the energy price continues to come down as a result of all sorts of a very wide number of technological developments, what they argue is, you know, basically time will take Russia down on its own. They don't really have to do it.
I think that's a big delusion. I mean, it would take a lengthy reply, but first of all, Russians know that the energy prices are going to go down. They're calculating for pretty low ones. They have other resources, water, non-GMO foods, high-tech, aerospace. They have all sorts of, and always remember, they're joined now at the hip with China. So as long as those two are big enough to essentially grow completely in autonomy, because they're exchanging what they're a perfect match for each other. They're exchanging things that they need very much. And there's also somewhere just laws of nature at play. I mean, almost, I would say, in a dialectical way. I mean, the United States has overstretched and over-alienated the entire planet. So it doesn't take necessarily, just like the U.S. did not bring necessarily Russia, the Soviet Union, down, but it sort of collapsed by itself. I see that also happening here. I don't think it's a Russia versus U.S. alone, but Russia happening to ride a wave which is much bigger than Russia, and that wave will bring down the U.S.
Well, here's, I guess I...
It's a combination of factors.
I don't look at it on a national basis as much. You know, to me, if you look at two recent meetings, you had the Asian Infrastructure Bank meeting, and you had the St. Petersburg meeting, and what you see when you look at both meetings is you've got a whole bunch of people saying, let's build the new world. Let's go build the Silk Road. Let's build the Maritime Silk Road. Let's build high-speed trains. Let's, you know, and ultimately what you find about people is they want to get something positive done. And if you look at everyone who's saying, let's go get something positive done, you know, increasingly it's not the Americans. You know, Americans are doing witch hunting.
Correct.
Right. And so I think the problem is the once upon a time, America was the let's go, you know, let's go do this, let's go do that. We were the let's go do guys. And we've lost that. And so every productive person on the planet consciously is moving away from the American leadership because, you know, I'm sure they're doing let's do something, but a lot of the cool things are secret, with some exception. So
precisely,
that's the
and
challenge.
That is what I'm trying to say is that every time somebody comes up with, say, a Silk Road or something like this, a plan, a let's do something thing, the empire says, unless we control it, we're going to try to sabotage it. And
right.
that
And,
attitude makes the entire unites the planet against the empire.
Right, but what just happened on the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank over the last 2 to 3 years is that plan not only failed, it failed spectacularly, publicly, visibly, and America,
yep.
you know, it's one of the
yep.
biggest diplomatic black eyes we have. You know, we're
yep.
the spoiler,
yep.
not the builder. Now, what was so interesting is when Trump first came in and he met with Abe, you know, you could tell the two of them were, let's build this, let's build that. You know, I literally expected to see the next headline coming out, they're ready to do space elevators because the Japanese are the ones, you know, promoting
yeah,
space
yeah,
elevators.
Yeah.
But, you know, but Trump's a builder. And so, you know, you could see Trump and the Japanese say, let's go build everything. And it was going in a very positive direction until we hit April 1st and, you know, back to the Middle East and the squabble. So to me, part of what we need to figure out how to do is you now have way too many people making money from debt, crime, and war. How do we get them addicted to building things instead of blocking and, you know, destroying things? I don't have the answer, but that's, to me, that's the obstacle in moving to, you know, maybe it's just, you know, they're making too much money destroying things instead of building it. And that's why I look at what's going on in Qatar and I worry, you know, if it's this hard to build things and it's this, you know, it's easy to destroy things. You got too many people making money from destroying things.
Well, let's see if they manage to destroy Qatar. We can discuss that at the next interview that we do. I predict that Qatar will resist.
So
we'll see if it happens. But at least resist, let me see. They might compromise, but I don't think they will destroy Qatar.
The next 3 months, what should we look for? What do you think is important to watch over the next 3 months?
Internal processes in the United States. Right now, to me, this is the single most important issue is that, you know, will they succeed in thoroughly destroying everything Trump wants to do, or say, let's the Tillerson line, if you want, we can call it that, or will Trump succeed in gradually, you know, regaining control of the country and making a difference? Because I think this is truly crucial right now, is what's happening inside. Outside the United States right now is almost paralyzed, I would say. There's nothing left. I would be hard pressed for me to name a foreign policy issue the United States is actually constructively involved in right now. It's paralyzed by the inner struggle here, and I think that's where things could happen. Of course, there's this announced meeting between Putin and Trump somewhere down the line. We'll see what happens there, and if something positive can happen, that's about it. Qatar, obviously, and more of the same, only worse in the Ukraine. I mean, there's nothing good happening there. The country's falling apart. I don't think there's going to be anything happening with the DPRK. I think it was all hot air. And I don't think the U.S. has the means of its policy in Syria either. So there was an attempt now by, you know, retaking Raqqa and pushing south towards Deir ez-Zor. That's not working either. I think I would say what's happening inside the country in terms of the people around Trump and whether the deep state will succeed in completely overthrowing him or he will succeed in gradually, you know, somehow building a basis for himself to start getting change and reform in this country. This is what I would be looking for.
Well, it's very unlikely they have the votes to impeach him before the 2018 elections. If the Democrats can win the Senate, you know, maybe they get the votes to impeach him, but I think before then, it's basically not possible. So,
you don't think the Democrats will vote for him for impeaching him? The Republicans, I'm sorry.
I don't think you're going to get enough. I just don't see how you do that before 2018. I think the Democrats have to make significant headway in the elections in 2018 to, you know, so I think you're looking at 2019. So, now, that doesn't mean you can't basically tie his hands up in the bureaucracy every which way. But here's where this is going to play out, because if you look at what is making policy in the United States, it's the budget. It's coming down to money. So the reason you can't get anything resolved on tax reform, for example, is budget. And so Trump has put out his first budget, and the budget process is going to roll through the appropriation committees between now and the recess in June, late June or July. And then they'll go out, the Bohemian Grove will meet, make all kinds of decisions, and then you'll come back in, implement, the House and the Senate will come back after Labor Day, and then you've got basically decisions to be made by October 1. And so between now and October 1, you're going to have a policy discussion through the budget, because that's what makes it real. Are you willing to fund it? And it's going to, you're really going to see it come out in the interaction. And the big one to me is tax reform, not healthcare, because the healthcare situation can't be, you can't achieve an economic solution in Washington. But you can on tax reform, but it's a budget issue. So watch the budget process to see how this policy discussion evolves, because ultimately what we do is going to be what we fund, and all these questions are going to break open. And part of the problem is what we need, Saker, is we need to have an honest conversation about the budget issues. And the problem is so much money is on the covert side and going down the covert side that you can't have an honest conversation, which is why transparency is essential if we're going to get to a healthy place. So we'll just have to watch and see what happens. But it will be very interesting, because one thing Trump and his team have done, you know, one of their greatest strengths is they brought transparency to things that had no honest conversation before, you know, whether it was Common Core, vaccines, or anything. So let's see if they open up the conversation. I don't know what's going to happen.
Let's hope they open up the conversation and don't spend the rest of the time ducking accusations of being Russian spies and, you know, Manchurian candidates or other charges of God knows what, corruption and whatever is coming next. I think the mud will continue flying, personally. I'm very pessimistic.
Well, but here's the problem. If you're the Democrats, you know, how do you please the oligarchs without spending money? You do it by witch hunting. Witch hunting is the only thing.
You put Pence in power.
I don't think they have the... How are you going to do that without an impeachment? I mean, you can.
I'm afraid of an impeachment. I absolutely do. I think that's what they're gunning for. And I don't trust the Republicans one bit. If the choice is between an expendable Trump and a Pence that everybody in the deep state will love, it's going to be a lot of pressure building up. The media... Problem is, the bad guys control both Congress and the media, which, in other way, means, right, you know, all the political pressure. And we both agree that the law is not what's essential here. The politics and the money take over, the prime law. So they can do whatever they want. Lawlessness will just continue.
Well, I don't know. I would give the odds of pushing a successful impeachment before getting more Democrats in is less than 25%. You would say it's much higher.
I hope you're right. No, I wouldn't put a figure on it, but I'm afraid of it, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, Saker, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Salieri Report. This has been very rich. Would you just give people a second about, remind them where your website is, how to find your fantastic book?
Yeah, you can go to the website. It's thesaker.is, which stands for Iceland. That's where I run our servers. And you can get the book through that. On the website, you can get the book there. Or get it on Amazon. It's called The Essential Saker.
And let me tell you something. Not only will you learn a great deal about the world, but you'll laugh your head off. It's I don't know.
Hopefully.
No, it's so rich with insights, but it makes you laugh. It's a wonderful. But you have to write another one. That's all I can tell you. I'm
working on it right now.
Perfect. Okay. Okay, Saker, have a great quarter, and we look forward to talking to you again in 3 months.
Okay, thank you so much. It was wonderful. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.